I'm really grateful that you mentioned QAnon, because when you said, you know, everyone was impressed how quickly ISIL spread on the internet, my argument would have been, yes, but I mean, look how quickly QAnon spread globally on the internet on a range of extremely absurd ideas. Obviously, ISIL propaganda very quickly gained the attention of everyone around the world because they put up extremely horrific images of beheadings and mass killings. So, you know, it became very clearly obvious what the threat is. With QAnon, it was simply for a long time perceived as a group of weirdos who are absolutely bereft of any rationality. But January 6th has demonstrated, if the attack on the pizza shop in Washington, D.C. a couple of years earlier wasn't warning enough, that even these weird ideas can lead to physical world violence. And we as CEP would not single out the U.S. government alone as having not quite in the last couple of years understood the magnitude of the new aspects of this extreme right-wing or, you know, white supremacist, whatever your terminology is going to be, because it does have changed, as we published last year a big report on the transnational connections. And in our assessment after our analysis last year, which was quite in-depth in several countries, is that the transnational aspect is not only very new, it's also now an integral part of how the movement functions. So you can't think about a German extreme right-wing terrorist group or network without connections to Scandinavia, without connections to the US, and vice versa, connections of the US networks, at least online and before COVID also offline, to European networks. So we do have something that is, I don't want to overstate this, but ISIL-like in the way it functions. It has affiliates outside the country of origin. It does function transnationally. Events in one country immediately are reflected. So the 6th of January attack was immediately perceived as a challenge by German right-wing extremists who tried to storm the German parliament in summer last year, and they're now calling for a repeat of that attempt. So, you know, events reverberate transatlantically, at least.
What kind of tactics are at play in this radicalization of QAnon folks here in the U.S.? I've seen several interviews of people who say that they lost their families, they lost their homes, they lost everything because they were so far down the QAnon rabbit hole. What is it that, and what moves these people to go this far?
Yeah, look, this is the, unfortunately, again, very similar to ISIL, because both are very cult-like. And the one way that ISIL recruited and the one way that QAnon followers are created is, number one, is social isolation. You do not talk to the non-believers because they will bring you from the narrow, straight path of truth. That's step one. The social isolation then serves as a mechanism to bind you stronger to the movement and to buy further into their imagined reality. So ISIL has an emergent reality, so does QAnon. And so the social isolation element is crucial for you to be able to buy into the movement. And at a certain point, it is very hard to get out of that social isolation again, because you are in a really different reality. And you know, the permissiveness of the online sphere is, of course, greatly enabling and accelerating the building up of this alternative reality. If you only talk to people who think the same that you think, reality will look different in your head to what it really is. And that's the same thing with QAnon, it's the same thing as it was with ISIL, that you get so far down the rabbit hole that getting out by yourself is a great act of self-discipline. And in some cases, you can't even do this by yourself. You actually need to go through a de-radicalization program. So in a way, we see great similarities between the radicalization processes between ISIL and QAnon or other white supremacists, because it is both, you know, a cult-like structure.
That is absolutely brilliant, Dr. Schindler. Thank you for explaining that so well and so succinctly, because I've asked numerous people and no one has been able to break it down in a minute and a half that way. I mean, people have taken 30 minutes to tell me not much at all. But what you did was very, very, very beneficial. A couple of more questions. What can and should be done about this online extremism and their ability to do things like what QAnon has done?
Yeah. So, look, there is now an ongoing discussion about a domestic extremism or domestic terrorism law equal to the Patriot Act in 2001. One can make very good arguments for this, but this is also, as you may remember, a very intrusive piece of legislation. It was a very intrusive piece of legislation into the liberties of the individuals. I remember very vividly that you know, you had to. There was the idea, even Barnes and Nobles, that they would have to tell the security forces what books or if certain types of books were bought in 2001. So there is a measure of caution that needs to be applied when you're countering domestic violent extremism versus clearly a foreign foreign terrorism threat, the likes of ISIL, Al-Qaeda. But there needs to be a hard and long look at what legislative and judicial instruments you have to counter this threat. On the online sphere, as we have been arguing from the CP side now, since our inception, this industry can no longer be left alone. It is not incentivized enough to strategically solve problems of terrorism content, hate crime content, content that incites violence, because there is no no commercial incentive to do so, because it's a very small part of the overall content. So advertisers apparently do not pay enough attention or do not care enough, as you've seen after January 6th. Some advertisers didn't advertise with Facebook for a couple of days, and then they came back because it's the biggest advertisement platform that exists globally. So no commercial incentive. There is no incentive because Section 230 indemnifies those platforms pretty much 100% of any third-party content on their platforms. Europe is working through this. In about 6 weeks, there will be the terrorist content online regulation being finally decided by the Parliament and the European Commission, which will require platforms, if they get notified at least, of terrorism content, to remove those within 24 hours or occur quite steep fines, up to 4% of their annual turnover, which is a fine that platforms will pay attention to if they're global platforms. And we need some rules. Freedom of speech is not guaranteed by commercial enterprises because they will restrict speech according to commercial interests. And this is what they do right now on Facebook and Twitter. Our argument is, in order to safeguard freedom of speech, societies, i.e. the parliament, the elected representatives of the people, should decide where the limits of the freedom of speech are, or courts should decide, but not companies. And therefore, you need a regulation that says, here are the guardrails. This is content that is gray area, you know, not nice, but not a danger to society. And this is clearly illegal content. We do not want to have bomb-making videos. We do not want to have them organize attacks online. We do not want them to celebrate an attack against the innocent Muslim community in New Zealand, or celebrating the murder of innocent Asian women. That just has to stop. This is speech that is actually dangerous to the security of each American or each European.
Dr. Hans-Jacob Schindler, Senior Director at the Counter-Extremism Project. J.J. Green, WTOP News.